Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein Online. It's Thursday, June 21st, 2007, the only June 21st, 2007 in the history of humanity. Let's keep that in mind as we go down the road on the webcast known as Glenn Klein Online. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a dress rehearsal. This is not a practice run. This is it, and we hope that you are making the best of it wherever you are logging in tonight. On this particular Thursday night. You know, if you knew tonight and today, whether you are listening live or on the archive, was the last day that you were going to be on the planet, what would you be doing? Would you be listening to this webcast right now? Would you be working today? Would you be going to your local tavern tonight? What would you be doing if you knew that this was the last day that you were on the planet? Because the fact of the matter is, and this is not a morbid thought, this is just reality, at some point, it's going to be your last day. I mean, the last thing that the people on September 11th thought was they went up the elevator in the World Trade Center was that a jet airliner was going to land in their lap that morning. But that's what happened. And that's the fact. Eventually, this is all coming to an end. And so, as I ask people this question all over the country as I speak, very rarely do people who are in the workplace say, well, I'd be right here, but that's where they're at. So the question really isn't what you would be doing, but how you would be doing what you do. I know exactly what I will be doing on the last day of my life. I will be doing exactly what I'm doing today, which is endeavoring to have a good time, to make a difference, and to have an impact on the earth. So with that perspective in mind, those of you who are regular listeners to this show know what our attitude is. We're all about progressing forward. And also those of you who are experienced listeners to the Glenn Klein Online webcast know that a longtime guest, in fact, I was a co-host of his program, was the former Libertarian presidential candidate Harry Brown, who ran as a standard bearer for the Libertarian Party in 1996 and the year 2000. And the late, great Harry Brown, I might say, because Harry passed away this last year from Lou Gehrig's disease. But I got to know Harry Brown very well, a very, very great man. And during this time, as I began to embrace libertarian perspectives and what I would call a more clear understanding of the Constitution and how our government was founded, I got to talking to a friend of mine named Brian Pitlick, who's the vice president of Pitlick and Wick Incorporated. I've only said that 5,000 times, Brian, but there I screwed it up on the radio. Pitlick and Wick Incorporated in Eagle River, Wisconsin. He's got a civil engineering degree from the University of Wisconsin in Platteville. And Brian is one of the finest libertarian thinkers that I know. Brian, welcome online tonight. How are you doing up there in the north?
Good. Beautiful day in northern Wisconsin, and glad to be here.
All right, so I'm in Tampa today. It's about 90 degrees, about 95% humidity. Give our listeners around the world an idea of what the weather was like in northern Wisconsin today.
Clear blue sky all day, about 70 degrees, maybe 74 degrees, and a nice south breeze off the lake.
Oh, that is so fantastic. My son Isaac and daughter Gracie are at camp up there right now. That warms the cockles of my heart just to think about that they were in that versus this sweat box down here today. But we're happy nonetheless. Brian, let me and let the folks who are listening right now have an understanding of a little bit about your background and how you began tapping into what is generally called a libertarian view or what I call a freedom-embracing perspective.
Well, I was actually thinking about that a little bit today, and you know, what I came up with, Glenn, was that really I always was a libertarian, but it was a process of over 15 years that I actually determined or knew that that occurred. In other words, you know, people who believe in the Constitution and the principles that this country was founded on, by definition, are libertarians. But many, many people do not recognize that because they get caught in the left-right conservative-liberal trap
right.
That is really made to you know, put a divider among groups of people so that we cannot effectively pursue the goals that we want. And so I think it really occurred by the age of 30. It occurred by reading Harry Brown's book, Ayn Rand's books, such as Atlas Shrugged, And then meeting people that think in a like-minded manner, such as yourself. There's a gentleman that I work with at the office that has been a libertarian since the early 70s. And just through that process of being in business and dealing with people and having to obtain multiple government permits and deal with the agencies, it's just the frustration level was so high that I just began to read and educate myself on the libertarian principles.
This is Glenn Klein Online. We're talking with Brian Pitlick tonight about constitutional government, a libertarian political perspective, if you will. And you can email us tonight your questions if you're listening live at coach@glennkleinonline.com. That's coach@glennkleinonline.com with any of your questions or comments for Brian this evening. Brian, a real turning point for me was when I was a kid and talking to my grandfather, who was a bootlegger back during the Prohibition era. And when Prohibition was repealed, of course, Prohibition doesn't work, and it didn't work. And when it was finally repealed, my grandfather went on to sell alcohol legitimately for Cutty Sark. He sold scotch his whole life. He had a big old Cadillac that was wrapped like a Cutty Sark scotch bottle, and he would drive into our neighborhood. It was always a classic moment, big yellow Cadillac. And I started thinking about the government's policy vis-a-vis marijuana and how schizophrenic their attitude was towards marijuana. They had to have a constitutional amendment to make alcohol illegal, but then just one day, marijuana went from being legal to being illegal. And it just made absolutely no sense to me. And of course, this so-called war on some drugs is absolutely the most ridiculous and double standard policy you could possibly have, and it doesn't work. And from that point, I started looking into other libertarian perspectives and other viewpoints vis-a-vis the government and the way the government interacts with us. Our government, during the Boston Tea Party and what really caused the revolution of this country, I believe it was a 3% tax. Brian, if people knew actually what they paid in taxes, they think they pay 15% or 25% or 40% income tax. But if people actually knew what the government was taking out in taxes every single day of their life, there would be another American Revolution, wouldn't there?
Yeah, I think it was something like in 1902 that it was estimated that the taxes consumed about 8% of an individual's income. In 1994, it was 47%, and I think the latest figure out is something around 54%. And of course, one of the greatest schemes ever devised was to actually take that withholding tax out of people's paychecks with their employer doing that work. And so most people today do not even look at the tax portion of their paycheck. And I was just discussing this with a couple of our employees Saturday afternoon. We were loading some rock out in the pit, and we sat down when we got done, and I said, just think if you had to pay that in at the end of the year, but you don't notice. The average person does not notice that because it's automatically deducted, and it just continues to grow.
We're talking with Brian Pitlick, the vice president of Pitlick & Wick in Eagle River, Wisconsin. As I said at the top of the webcast, one of the finest libertarian thinkers that I know today, and we're bringing him to you all over the planet today. Because, here we have installed a so-called democratic government in Iraq, and our situation here is so screwed up. One of the most ironic things that I found is after Saddam Hussein was overthrown, there was General Tommy Franks, of course, who's headquartered down here, or was headquartered in Central Command down here in Tampa. And he went into Baghdad and did a victory lap, and he went into all of Saddam's palaces with all of his lieutenants, etc. And they were all smoking victory cigars inside Saddam Hussein's palaces. And yet, at that very time, Florida passed a law that you can't smoke inside anymore at restaurants. And I thought, there's something wrong with this picture here. Here we, Brian, we're trying to import something that we have so messed up here, it don't work.
Well, it doesn't work at all. And then, the very concept that a private business, cannot choose the type of customers that they would like to market to, of course, is, it's absurd. And if the founding fathers would have known something like that was to occur, they certainly would be rolling over. And yet we profess to be spreading freedom around the world, but we've lost you know, we've lost more freedom in the last 10 years probably than we did in the 50 before it. And, you know, in that 50, we lost more than in the 150 before that. So, you know, what's really disturbing is the rate, really.
Where did this all start? How did it all start? When this country was founded on individual liberty and personal freedom, and we've gotten to the place right now where, as you say, an individual can't make a decision for themselves to have a business where they will allow people to have a cigar or a cigarette if they have a drink or a cocktail. How did this all start?
I think it started from the minute that the Constitution was signed and the states, you know, the original states were formed. And, you know, there certainly everybody was not in agreement with those principles. So I think it started right there. And, you know, there was over from then until the Civil War, there were small experiments or, you know, transgressions outside of the constitutional boundaries. But the Civil War was really the first time that the federal government abused its power and adopted an income tax and, you know, arrested people without trial. And so that's where it really started. And then, it's been a steady progression since then and accelerating.
And that's the problem. It's like a snowball going down a hill. I mean, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, we laud Abraham Lincoln for many historians believe he's the greatest president in the history of the United States. And yet, he suspended habeas corpus. They think George Bush with the Patriot Act is bad. Could you imagine of what the left's response would have been to Abraham Lincoln and people who care about civil liberties during those days? And obviously there was an uproar, but, I mean, he was, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but he was the closest thing we've ever had to a dictator.
I would agree with that. And we talked the other night, Glenn, and, you know, one of the points that we agreed on was, you know, if it could just ever stop accelerating, everybody, you know, that's probably something that we could all endure. But it is not stopping. It is accelerating. And, you know, from the anti-smoking crusade to the ever-stiffening prohibition policies in regards to driving and the failed war on drugs, and it just continues. And it's a concern, and especially as a parent, it's a concern. You know, we seem to have a society that no longer accepts the youthful, the errors of our youth, and we expect, you know, our youth to be held to such a high standard. I'll tell you, it's my number one concern as a parent is that the children of today cannot be children. Or I don't even mean to say children, but to make mistakes that all of us through recorded history have made.
What do you mean specifically? What are you referencing?
When we were young, you know, the youth of, you know, the youth drinks beer, the youth smokes pot. It's not necessarily right, but over time, you know, large segments of the population of that, you know, 16 to 20 year old category do those things. And when I was young and when you were young, you know, the cops might get caught doing that, and they would knock on your door and they would inform your parents, and then your parents would hand out the discipline.
Right.
But if you get pulled over now and you're just a passenger, not driving, and you're caught with a beer under the age of 21, you know, you have a record.
Right.
And so it's just it's everybody's playing to win at the expense of everybody else, and there's just no room for error, because those things will be on your record and they will affect your work progress and your advancement at work and the things you do in life, because that record never goes away. So we seem to have lost our forgiveness for what I would consider normal behavior of the youth.
It's a great point. We talk a lot about on this webcast about the controlling personalities that certain people have, and they tend to gravitate towards certain professions like law enforcement, like religion, like teaching, and like camp directing, if you will. And as many of you beautiful humans know, I'm a former camp director, so I understand the personality. But when we have a thing like the Patriot Act, and a guy who's president, who clearly has got some serious control issues, this is what's lauded. This is what's applauded. And what we have are more and more people gravitating to those professions in hope, I believe, of straightening out their own lives while they try to straighten out other people's lives. And, you know, people that live in glass houses should not throw stones. And this is what we have. We have a result, exactly what you said, a patriarchal society where people can't make decisions for themselves and parents are being arrested for just disciplining their children, for God's sakes. This is a problem.
It's a huge problem, and you see it all the time. And that is my number one concern.
All right, well, you've had some pretty significant success in northern Wisconsin making an inroad with libertarian values in local government, and it's all about grassroots efforts. Why don't you let our listeners in on some of the successes you guys have had and what you've done and how you have done it?
Well, typically, you know, I live in Oneida County. Vilas County is right to the north, and they're two very similar counties. And, you know, over time, the first county zoning ordinance in America was actually put into effect in Oneida County, and they're proud of that. Many of the residents are not, and so
I did not know that.
Yes, it's actually, they have a plaque at the courthouse, and much to my chagrin. But over time, you know, the power of that bureaucracy grew like it always does in any agency. And it actually reached a point in the mid-90s, 1995 to 1998, some of the new shoreland ordinances that were enacted for how close you can build a house to the lake and setbacks and things like that were occurring and being enacted. And it got to the point where they were actually tearing down people's houses, forcibly making them tear them down and move them back to meet setback requirements.
Right.
If there was any small violation, such as cutting too many trees or spending too much on a remodeling on a non-conforming structure. So it was in 1998 that a group of people in Oneida County, it was a small group, started out, and we formed a group called Taxpayers for Fair Zoning. And, you know, the name of the group really defines it as reasonable rules and regulations that protect the environment, yet protect private property, which is, you know, the cornerstone of many of our freedoms. And at first, our group was ignored, but we were well-organized. We met weekly for over 2 years with a small group of people and eventually had several thousand members, dues-paying members. And we set about attending public hearings, meetings, and actually at the end, we're controlling the debate. And by controlling, I mean, you know, putting the other side of the information out there so people could make decisions with both sides of the issue. And I think it was in the year 2000, seven of the board members were unelected that we thought were against private property rights.
Particularly and heinous to property owners.
Yes, overbearing.
Yes.
And so it was a good learning experience that you can, you know, if determined enough and organized enough, that you can have an effect, and it's probably best to start at the local level. Now, the other thing we learned out of that is we did enact many changes in the Oneida County ordinance, made the ordinance much friendlier to the residents that live here. But what also happened was the state then, the Department of Natural Resources, really took it upon themselves and enacted the changes that we were against at a state level. And that process is actually still occurring today.
Right. And that's kind of at the heart of the libertarian perspective, is that government works best when it's as local as it can be. And, of course, Oneida County is about 3.5 hours away from Madison, Wisconsin, which is the state capital. So you have the legislators that are, of course, dominated by the cities of Milwaukee and Madison, making laws for people that live in the North Woods and other rural areas. And then, of course, we have the federal government in Washington, D.C. doing the same damn thing for people all over the country. And then you have this massive bureaucracy that happens, and people do not, out of self-interest, act in those bureaucracies. They're just trying to cover their ass, and we have the mess that we have today. What is the current status of the relationship with what you guys did and with the state government in Wisconsin right now?
Well, the Oneida County ordinance has stayed relatively the same over the last 2 years. So those changes were enacted, and there's new committee members, and it runs pretty well. But what's happening at the state level, there's an overriding natural resource statute called NR 115, and that was written in the mid-1960s. And it was actually, that's a state statute that's administered through the county. And while they were making progress tearing down people's houses because of non-conforming status, they were satisfied to let that be. But as soon as we resisted in Oneida County, what we have now is a rewritten draft of NR 115 coming out that is actually going to then statutorily at the state level make those changes. Stricter shoreline rules, increased setbacks, stricter building restrictions. So it's really being pushed through now at the state level.
This is Glenn Klein Online. We're talking with Brian Pitlick, the Vice President of Pitlick and Wick at the Eagle River, Wisconsin. We're talking about libertarian values and principles versus, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, what we see dominating our government and our political system today. We've got time yet this evening to take your emails and your questions and comments. The email address here, excuse me, is coach@glennklineonline.com. That's coach@glennklineonline.com. We have this email from Lewis from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He says, Brian, with the Republican Party, having taken over both the Congress and the presidency, and then having increased government spending to record levels, what hope do we libertarians have when the conservative party, the so-called conservative party, he says, of the United States, ends up increasing government spending by more than the liberal party did? It's a good question.
Excellent question. I think we talked about that the other night, just between you and I, and I stated to you that I used to be a Republican because I believed in the concepts of limited government, limited taxation, personal freedom, and I grew up thinking that, the Republican Party was the one that was going to protect those values. And it was really that disappointment from what the email says, from the conservative, what's supposed to be the conservative, fiscally conservative party, who is, had record budgets, record spending, and really has allowed government to grow in every facet, every agency. Nothing is ever reversed. So I lost hope on that about 10 years ago. And that's really when I switched. And people used to say that my vote as a libertarian was a wasted vote, but I've actually turned that argument around on them. And any vote that is not for a third party at this point in this country is a wasted vote.
Correct.
Because the two-party system is really a one-party system that is made to divide and conquer us on issues that, although they matter, are really issues that are placed before us to separate us. And it's pro-labor, pro-management, for example, pro-environment, anti-environment. And most people in America do not fit in those broad categories that they like to put us in.
Right.
I don't know anybody that wants to breathe dirty air and drink dirty water. And yet business is viewed as anti-environment. And if you're on the left, so to speak, you're viewed as pro-environment. But people I know are all pro-environment.
Mm-hmm.
We live in one of the most beautiful areas of the United States, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
And to group people in those categories is really to divide us. And there's many more examples. So I would submit that if any vote for either of those two parties is a wasted vote, because it does not matter of those two parties who wins. The government agencies will increase in both power, size, and budget. And they are leapfrogging us toward a end result that, that none of us will like.
This is Glenn Klein Online. Lewis, thank you for your comments and your question. But to his point, Brian, about what hope libertarians have, I remember after the 2000 election, and of course, we both supported Harry Brown, and Harry was a good friend of ours, and as I said earlier, a frequent guest on the show, and I eventually co-hosted his radio show. And his goal was to get 1 million votes in 2000, and of course, that election was so close, and he ended up not even getting 500,000. And I remember walking into your bar up there, Pitlick Sand Beach Resort there on beautiful Sand Lake in northern Wisconsin, and we hadn't seen each other since the election, and you know, we both were shaking our head, and you said to me, well, I'm going to become an anarchist, and we laughed about that. But is there hope for those of us who are libertarian and who view the Constitution seriously?
Well, I think there is. The disappointment in the 2000 election when Harry Brown ran, and the disappointment that libertarians have when the government programs increase and intrude into our lives has to be overcome on an individual basis in your life with your family. You have a responsibility to your family, to your children. And, you know, I've just taken the viewpoint that I'm one person. I will make an effect where I can. I will raise my children as libertarians. Then we will become five. They will raise their children with the same values, hopefully, not necessarily, but hopefully, if they see that it works, which it does. And so I think we have to have long-term goals. And we lost our freedom over a 200-year span, and we're not going to get it back overnight. And we just have to promote the ideas of freedom and individual liberty, parental responsibility, and move on in your own life without letting it ruin your life.
I like how you said that, individual liberty and responsibility. That's a huge part of the libertarian message. And as you beautiful humans know, Dawn and I have six children. Brian and his wife have three children I've been pleasured to get to know and witness up close and personal the effect that your child-rearing techniques have had. This perspective starts right at the kitchen table, doesn't it? I mean, how did your political evolution and your libertarianism involve and inform your parental process with your kids? Because, I mean, you've got three of the most awesome kids that I know, other than mine.
Well, I very consciously, when my children were at about the age of three, and they're 14, 13, and 11 right now, but I very, very consciously used the idea of letting them make decisions for themselves. And so, I mean, it starts very young. We're going to church. Do you want to go? Do you not want to go? We're going to go to a basketball game. Would you like to go? Would you not like to go? Most people just say, we're going here. And immediately, as the children get older, they begin to question that. What I've tried to do is take that out and put in a thought process where they actually begin the thinking process of, do I want to or do I not to? And what are the consequences either way? And so that combined with the fact that, you know, I'm fairly active in the Taxpayers for Fair Zoning group and political discussions and from the books that I have in my house, you know, and which some of my children read. And so they've just seen it. They've actually just lived it. And they see what, you know, they see what I have to go through at work with the permitting process and the endless hours of work, which is not productive work. 10 years ago, I was a productive worker as far as I was actually helping the company earn money, you know, actually out on the job. And in a 10-year span, it's translated into, you know, dealing with regulations on almost a full-time basis. And it the point I brought up before was, you know, people don't want dirty water, dirty air, and they don't want unsafe workplaces, and neither do most owners of the business, you know, 999 out of 1,000 people. And we tend to make rules in this society for the 1 out of 10,000 bad apples. Have you ever noticed that?
That's exactly right. I mean, we make rules, we make laws, we freak out about the one thing that happens, instead of looking at the vast majority of situations that are safe, that instead of reinforcing the positive, it's just human nature. We dwell on the negative, and we get the kind of government that results from that kind of thinking.
Right, and there are positives every day, from individual examples to parental examples to corporate examples of environmental stewardship safety programs that go above and beyond the written law, and incentive programs that make those things happen. And so those successes are out there if we look for them. I mean, the problem with much of the environmental law, of course, is it's dictated to us by people that are in unelected positions. Boards of adjustment, planning committees.
Right.
You know, I mean, these are people that are not directly held accountable to the people through the election process. And that's scary.
But you do have hope.
You have to have hope. You have to have hope. And I don't see it as an end-all situation. It's just a very frustrating situation. But yet you cannot let that affect your personality or your personal lives or your family.
And that's what I have witnessed with your life and with your personality and with your family. And every time that we talk, it gives me hope. It encourages me. It inspires me. And that's why I wanted the beautiful humans to hear you tonight. And I so appreciate your time. I know it's been a long day up there in northern Wisconsin, but we'll have to do it again sometime. But thanks so much, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Glenn.
That's Brian Pitlick, the Vice President of Pitlick and Wick in Eagle River, Wisconsin. And you can get emails to us, as always, with your comments and questions at coach@glennklineonline.com. Yeah, it's easy for me to say. It's coach@glennklineonline.com. Thanks so much for listening. I want to thank Patrick L. Jones, our producer and engineer, and we will talk to you soon. This is Glenn Klein Online saying, Shalom, everybody!